Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
Catch those springtime vibes all over Arizona. Break out of the winter blues by hitting the water at one of our lake and river parks. Take a hike among the wildflowers. Just make sure to stay on the trails and leave the flowers for the bees. Discover Arizona's best-kept secret and visit azstateparks.com/amazing to start your springtime adventure.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. As I record this, we just received news from the previous evening that one of the great monsters of the modern era, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, has died. Now, this is obviously, anyone who's listening to this podcast will have already read a great deal about it. I'm hoping that you read a lot of it in The Nation magazine, the sponsor of this podcast, because we have several excellent pieces, particularly from the historian Greg Grandin. There's so much to say about Kissinger, but also, you know, much to say about the state of the world. And to address both, I'm very happy to have on a friend of the podcast, Matt Duss, who's a senior figure at the Center for International Policy. And he recently wrote a very interesting piece in Foreign Affairs with his colleague Nancy O'Kale about the sort of war in Gaza, and also how this sort of ceasefire that is sort of currently in place as we're recording, how that can be built on to provide an alternative model to the, you know, sort of horrific war and violence that we're seeing. So we'll take up both topics, but I want to start with sort of Kissinger, because Matt had written a very interesting piece recently prior to Kissinger's death, bringing out an aspect of Kissinger's career which is not much discussed. And it has to be said about Kissinger, you know, like we can't, one of the interesting things about him is that one is always finding out like new atrocities that he was involved with. Like the archivists are having like a sort of field day over the last decades of like, you know, there's stuff that he did with like Spain and Morocco in North Africa that I had never heard about that I just found out. So there's so much to say about Kissinger, but I think the Matt's piece about Kissinger and buck raking, I think, was very interesting, and I want to see what he has to say about that.
Yeah, no, but first, as you said, even after the passing of such an artist as Kissinger, there will be new material that the will continue to be released as more and more is unearthed and shared. Yeah. But yeah, the piece I wrote, it was for the New Republic back in early June, amid, as I'm sure you and your listeners remember, this, you know, the just like, I don't know what to call it, the massive celebration and observance, the great national holiday of Henry Kissinger's 100th birthday, which is just wild. I mean, how many cakes does one man really need was a question I kept coming back to. But, you know, it also was an occasion, as ugly and really, you know, as revolting as the kind of establishment elite encomia for him was, I think it also was occasion for the beginning of what I think we are seeing now in the wake of his death is just a much more unvarnished take. I'm gratified to see as many, you know, really taking a clear, cold look at his legacy, which is one of enormous mass murder and coups and undermining of democracy. And that is kind of where my piece focused. As I note, this, it doesn't really compare to the millions of deaths for which he is responsible, but understanding, you know, what he did post-government, how he kind of, you know, was really the first to parlay his, you know, closeness to power and his celebrity into massive wealth. In terms of continuing to be an unofficial and sometimes official advisor to various secretaries of state and various administrations, while also having, you know, global mega corporations and foreign governments as clients, which is really incredible when you think about it.
Yeah, no, I mean, he's a real pioneer in that. And it's something that we've seen much more and more. I noticed that Tony Blair had issued a statement like sort of praising Kissinger and how much he owed to Kissinger. And I couldn't help but thinking that like Tony right. Blair like is exactly followed Kissinger's model in Precisely. The sense of both presiding over disastrous foreign policy,
right.
But then afterwards basically cashing out. With the sort of institute which that he runs, where he has like all sorts of ties with Middle yeah. Eastern autocrats. I mean, like right. it is the same basic thing. And so, I mean, the when we think of Kissinger's legacy, it shouldn't just be, you know, the horrific stuff he did while in public office. Like he actually mm-hmm. created a model for something right. more corrupt. And I'll just tell a story because I'm in working on a piece about Marty Peretz. You mentioned the New Republic, the former publisher of the New Republic yes. for many years, and who was in his autobiography talks quite warmly about Henry Kissinger, although he says, you know, like it's true that, you know, he was responsible for the death of like a quarter of the population of Cambodia, but, you know, he had his good side too.
Let's not bicker and argue over who killed who.
That's right. You know? That's right. But one of the things that, so while I was researching this piece on Peretz, I came across this very interesting story involving the New Republic and Kissinger. Which is that in the time of the first Iraq war in the early 1990s, the New Republic had published a very good investigative piece by Joe Connison, a really fine reporter.
Yep.
And it's about Kissinger Associates. And it was about the ties between the Kissinger Associates and Saddam Hussein. Because there was someone from the Kissinger Associates who went over
yep.
to Iraq under Saddam Hussein when a lot of business people were there. And it's very opaque as to what he was actually doing there, but he was like very much in the company of Saddam Hussein. And there were business interests that were very interested in making deals, including arms deals with Saddam Hussein that were part of this trip. So, I mean, that's a very... was a very good investigative piece. Kissinger wrote in a very angry letter, which the New Republic published. And the New Republic published this very curious editor's note saying that, you know, the piece is not meant to reflect on Dr. Kissinger. It was just like reporting the facts of this particular case, which is yeah. like, you know, if you're a reporter, that might not be what you want to hear. But it goes a bit further than that. A little while afterwards, 60 Minutes took up this and did a very long report. I think one of the longest episodes of 60 Minutes ever about Kissinger Associates and all its ties with various foreign autocrats. And while they were working on the piece, they had contacted Connison and also the New Republic because they wanted to quote from the piece. And they got in this letter from Marty Peretz. Saying basically putting down the piece, like saying, like, you know, we didn't do editorial due diligence for that. And at that point, Mike Wallace, you know, had called up or they were in touch with the New Republic and Peretz and saying, like, you know, like, we're going to quote this letter and it doesn't quite make you look good, you know, like disavowing your own writer. And then there was a follow-up letter from Peretz's lawyer saying, you know, like basically begging 60 Minutes not to quote from the first letter from Peretz, which is obviously an embarrassment.
Yeah.
I would say it realizes it's an embarrassment. And you know, 60 Minutes, to their credit, quoted both letters as well as having Joe Connison on because his original reporting held up.
So everybody won there.
I think that story is a remarkable example of something that is also very true about Kissinger, which is that he had this network of elite accomplices,
yes.
Especially in the world right. of journalism and the corporate the corporate world as well as in public service, and they often went along with him because they shared both his interests and his values. And so I think that too is part of Kissinger's legacy.
Quite right. And, you know, I'm not the first person to observe this. I'm trying to remember where I first read it, but like part of Kissinger's real genius was for flattery. Mm-hmm. It was for, you know, flattering the, you know, assumptions of elites about themselves, you know, their need to be kind of in the know, to be close to power, and using that for his own influence, but also protecting, you know, his reputation. And I think that's a great example. It might not have worked out exactly in that way, but overall, you know, I think you just look again a few months ago during his 100th birthday, all of the praise he was receiving, all the praise he'll receive over the next few days really goes to that success. But I also think, you know, that story you noted, one of the reasons it might be so unfamiliar is because what he started out doing is no longer seen as scandalous. I mean, this is how we do business in Washington. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, he was a pioneer in just essentially the normalization of corruption. And I think we really need to use that word. It is corruption. It is a conflict of interest. And as I write in my piece, even if one can't show exactly, you know, where his, you know, that he was kind of shading his policy advice for the benefit of his foreign government and multinational corporate clients, the point is we shouldn't have to wonder. Mm-hmm. You know, we would want to avoid the appearance of a conflict. And he absolutely dove right into that. And I think where this gets at the deeper problem in our democracy is that, you know, part of the kind of fertile soil of authoritarianism deals with, you know, this idea that you can believe nothing, that everyone is lying to you, that nothing is on the level. And that is part of Kissinger's legacy. I mean, it's, you know, I wrote earlier that he did more damage to our democracy than Trump. And I think that's part of what I mean, mm-hmm. is that he played a huge role in creating or laying the groundwork, mm-hmm. For this kind of conspiratorial, because it turns out sometimes the conspiracies are there. It turns out that sometimes we do secretly knock over democratically elected governments. So even when, you know, the U.S. government tries to do the right thing, there's always going to be, you know, some element that's saying, well, what's really going on here? Because they have real examples of that in the past.
Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And I mean, it gets at issue of like, you know, where does the erosion of trust come from? Because I think there is a kind of, you know, mainstream discourse that sort of, you know, points to social media and other things that are, you know, like very dubious and need to be challenged. But like, if you actually look at, you know, we have good social science on this in terms of public opinion and trust of government, like the real initial crisis of trust in the government came in the sort of 60s and early 70s with the Vietnam War and then with Watergate, you know, but Kissinger is associated with both. You know, like prior to that, like, you know, Americans had a great deal of trust in their public institutions. Yeah. And then for very good reasons, they started not to.
Yeah.
And then a revival of public trust, like initially after 9/11. And then what happened? Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. No, I always think back to the, you know, you had that like, that whole run of kind of conspiracy movies in the mid late 70s, like Parallax View, like 3 Days of the Condor, a number of others, I think, that reflect what you're saying, that moment. And like
the conversation, the
conversation. Right. Yeah. But I always think there's this scene, like the end, the big reveal at the end of 3 Days of the Condor, which is a fantastic movie, by the way, Robert Redford, Faye Dunaway, where he finds out that the CIA was all doing it for the oil. You know, which like, it's like, really, you know, when I watched that in like the early 90s, I was like, yeah, everyone knows this now. This is not a shock.
Yeah. No, it was a shock in the 70s. Yeah. Let's turn from Kissinger to, you know, the current situation in Israel and Gaza. Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, you have this piece in Foreign Affairs, which I'll link to in the show notes. And I would encourage everyone to like read it, because I think it brings out a very crucial thing, which is that, you know, we're currently in the last week or so had a respite from some of the carnage. There's still violence going on including in the West Bank. But yeah. it's at a lower level. There's a kind of touch and go ceasefire, which is, you know, running from day to day. But I think that the larger point that I got from the piece is that, you know, there are ways in which the ceasefire can offer a model to move on to build something, you know, like to go to, well, it's not even a ceasefire, it's a humanitarian pause, but to build from the humanitarian pause to a longer ceasefire, and then to build from the ceasefire to, like, what is actually needed, which is a return to negotiations on the status of the Palestinians. So one way let's think about this first as sort of a set of policy prescriptions. Then we can talk about how plausible this is. Like, first of all, like, so what are you kind of envisioning as a kind of, like, you know, like a best case scenario? Like, if you had your ideal Secretary of State and team in place, like, what do you think that they should be pushing for?
Well, one, as we say, extend the ceasefire, continue, you know, hopefully to lead into something that is longer term. I mean, to continue negotiations for the release of more hostages and the release of more Palestinian prisoners. Ultimately, dealing with the challenge of Hamas rule in Gaza is a very real one. But, you know, I think there's a lot of talk, and Secretary Blinken a few weeks ago in Tokyo laid out a set of principles that the administration has for post-war Gaza. One of which were there should be no return to the October 6th status quo, which is both good, but also, like, for anyone who's seen the images coming out of northern Gaza, there will be, I mean, the status quo is gone. There is no reality in which we would ever return to that, because northern Gaza is rubble. You know, close to, I think it's 1.8 million now displaced, fleeing into southern Gaza. But still taking that. So what does that mean? I think they mean that, you know, we cannot have Hamas ruling Gaza anymore. But I also was encouraged to say that there cannot be a continuation of the blockade, the siege on Gaza, which is 15 years old, which has been a constant part of this situation, which essentially is punishing civilians for the authoritarian, autocratic extremist group that rules them. But I think there's ways we can work with that and think through, okay, not just no return to the status quo for Gaza, but we have to have no return to the status quo for Palestine, Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. And that requires shifting, you know, to an actual process that creates a horizon to end the occupation, and for real Palestinian liberation. And this will require a real shift in policy from this administration. But if we're talking in ideal terms, it requires a recognition that you will not just kind of put this issue in the corner. I mean, I'm not going to pretend, nor does the piece pretend, that this will be easy. One of the big challenges is, as I said, Hamas in Gaza. I think the goal of eradicating Hamas is not feasible. I think people understand that. I think you can disempower Hamas. You can take steps so they do not continue to rule there. It is complicated. It will require, and again, this is not something the United States can do, because we have neither the right nor the ability to choose who speaks for the Palestinians, or who. But what we can do is support a process that helps end the division between, you know, the Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That facilitates and supports a democratic process where the Palestinian national movement can be reconstituted, such that you have a Palestinian leadership that can make credible commitments on behalf of the Palestinian people in a final agreement. And that's ultimately what we're talking about here.
Okay. Now, in terms of trying to work with the Palestinians as a unified group, one thing is, like, you know, that has not been the goal of the Israeli government, certainly recently, but I mean, like, arguably, like, ever. Like, there has been, you know, like, a kind of divide and rule strategy going back decades.
That's how Hamas came into being.
I mean, exactly, yeah. So the, for listeners who maybe are not familiar with the history, but, like, in the 80s, the Israeli government sort of bolstered Hamas as a way of undermining what they saw as the, well, you know, more dangerous secular leadership.
So let me, yeah, this goes back to the 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was originally because Hamas grew out of the Palestinian branch of the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm-hmm. So it began in Gaza. It was, and again, at this time, they were not militant. They were largely not political, although there is an element of course, politics in the Muslim Brotherhood's program. But it was a lot of essentially, you know, support, relief, and missionary work. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, this is a model the Muslim Brotherhood has followed, you know, kind of a lot of, you know, groups around the world in the Middle East, mm-hmm. and elsewhere have followed a similar model to develop support among the population in the face of an administrative state that is, you know, that is either ignores them or preys upon them. And mm-hmm. that's the situation that you had in the occupied territories. But the occupation, the Israeli occupation authorities kind of allowed the Muslim Brotherhood to grow, because they saw it as a useful way to divert support from the secular nationalist Fatah and the PLO.
Yeah.
So, yes. And as you said, in the 80s, around the first Intifada is when Hamas was created as, you know, out of the Palestinian Muslim Brotherhood as an explicitly militant organization.
Yeah, yeah. And even as it became a more militant organization, like even in the 80s, it was seen as a more... we're supporting as part of a kind of divide and rule strategy. Mm-hmm. So I mean, what we're basically calling on is for like Israel to forswear divide and rule, mm-hmm. and to like try to forswear. I mean, like what Benjamin Netanyahu, you know, the current leader. I mean, his explicit goal, as he's recently stated, was like, you need me, I'm the one who can stop Palestinian statehood, mm-hmm. right? Like, right. At its core, this is a policy that would like, you know, involve the United States, openly coming into conflict, yes. with right. Netanyahu's government, let's say at a minimum, right?
Right.
Perhaps like, also political forces larger than Netanyahu, but at a minimum, him. So, right. I think just acknowledging that, what are some of the frameworks that one could have? Like if, let's say, you know, like ideally one has an Israeli government that agrees to these sort of negotiations. Mm-hmm. I think in your piece, I mean, like you kind of suggest at least two major sort of pathways. And I think it's worth kind of fleshing out mm-hmm. what those are.
Right. I mean, so first we suggest bringing together what we call kind of the Aqaba group plus Qatar and Turkey. And so the Aqaba group were a set of regional governments that met in the context of the Abraham Accords mm-hmm. to talk about regional cooperation and normalization. Now, I mean, I think there's an element of that is important, although we really do advocate moving away from the Abraham Accords as a basis, mm-hmm. because I mean, people who say that, well, we can use the Abraham Accords as a way to address the Palestinian issue, I think fundamentally misunderstand what the Abraham Accords mm-hmm. are for. And they are for, in part, burying the Palestinian issue. So, yeah. I mean, it is you, I don't think you will use this tool for the opposite purpose for which it was created. However, I think just as a way of gathering some of the regional players, but adding Qatar and Turkey, both of whom have channels to Hamas. And again, the U.S. can facilitate this and can play a really important role. But part of the recognition here is that the U.S., you know, just cannot play the hegemon here. I mean, our credibility after this was already low, but after the past 2 months of this massacre is extraordinarily low. But we do remain, and we note this, the only country that has the relationship with Israel and can ultimately give Israel the security guarantees it will require to make an agreement. The second piece
of... I actually just want to hit on that point a little bit, because mm-hmm. I actually had a sort of curious thought about this. I mean, I think the point that you raise about like America's lack of credibility here mm-hmm. is kind of key. And I'm wondering whether... the kind of model that we saw with China coming in and setting up negotiations between Iran and Saudi Arabia, which it was able to do because it doesn't have the kind of baggage that the United States did.
Yeah.
Is there some sort of role that some like, you know, not necessarily even, this doesn't have to be even like China, but like, you know, some sort of other external power that has maybe less baggage in the scene as a more even-handed, like, is there some role for that?
Well, I mean, I first of all, I have a different interpretation of the role that China actually played in that, you know, detente between Iran and Saudi Arabia. I think that had been developing and in the works for some time. I mean, there had been meetings going that were, many of them, interestingly, kind of held and brokered in Iraq between Iran and Saudi Arabia. China, as I understand it, was kind of brought in toward the end. Not entirely for PR purposes, but largely for PR purposes, because this was a play by MBS to bid up the United States. And it worked fantastically. You know, I mean, the news broke here. You have, you know, you have China and they're, you know, doing the, you know, we're China's playing this role, which, you know, again, I think it's good. I want, you know, easier, less tense relations between Saudi Arabia and Iran. I think everyone should. But that was, you know, the audience for that was Joe Biden to say, like, listen, we have other options. And again, this is a familiar play. We saw this throughout the Cold War where authoritarian leaders is like, well, we could take a deal over here with the Soviet Union, or what are you going to offer us? And of course, the Biden administration has showed immediately, we want to offer you everything. We want to offer you a civilian nuclear program. We want to offer you a defense agreement. I mean, this was, you know, what came to be called the so-called Israel-Saudi normalization deal, which I've noted it was actually just a U.S.-Saudi defense pact that was kind of wrapped in a sweet candy coating of peace with Israel in order to try and sell it domestically here in the U.S. I think that's been put off for the time being, but I think those, the imperatives that underlie that still exist. But to your point, I think ultimately you do want to bring in other players, as tough as that will be, but particularly Iran. Now, I'm not saying Iran needs to be at the table, but that's again why we would want to add Turkey and Qatar to this round, is because they both have channels to both Hamas and to Iran. And you will not ice Iran out of the region. And again, that's not to defend or have any sympathy for what the Iranian regime does. It does a lot of horrible stuff to its own people and to others, but it is a player in the region. So, I mean, finding a way, you know, to get Iran's buy-in to a process is really important. And ultimately, listen, that could be a way into a broader, you know, negotiation with Iran, between Iran and the United States. I'm not super optimistic about that, but just kind of making the point that, you know, you're not going to have a successful process that just ices Iran out.
Oh, okay. So I mean, basically, what you're suggesting is that instead of using the Abraham Accords as a way of like shutting people out and start creating a defense pact, you know, like us against these other guys, but actually using it, some of the existing networks there, but to bring more people in, I think that makes sense. Although I will again note that that goes against a lot of the sort of bipartisan foreign policy consensus we've seen. At least since, like, you know, like you mentioned the Abraham Accords, you know, which like Biden took up on his own. So
I mean, I'll just stop here and say, I mean, let's look at, yes, I would agree that this cuts against, you know, the so-called bipartisan consensus, but how's that going?
You know, I agree.
How's that consensus working out?
But just to know, like we will need to get like some very powerful people rethinking. I will also say, I mean, like, you know, one saw glimmers of this, you know, like under Obama. Like, I think, you know, there were ways in which prior to the sort of, you know, Trump and the Abraham Accords, there were ways in which like the Obama administration was like heading in this direction of trying to bring in more people to the table.
Totally agree. So, I mean, this is part of what underlies.
There's some basis for this, like within the establishment.
And again, you're right. And to some extent, I am like imagining a can opener, right? In terms of like, let's imagine we have a president who wants to do this and is willing to put, you know, his or her political weight behind making the case for why this is the right path. I mean, as Obama did with the JCPOA, to say, listen, we, you know, this is a good agreement. It's not perfect. It, it puts a cap on Iran's nuclear program, and it creates the possibility of, you know, further negotiations, or at least bringing some stability to a relationship that has been very antagonistic. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. I mean, this does, you know, Joe Biden's career-long, you know, approach to the U.S.-Israel relationship has been no daylight. Mm-hmm. And I would argue that what we are seeing in Gaza right now is in part the result of no daylight. What we are seeing in the West Bank, you know, essentially, you know, just militia attacks against Palestinian civilians, which are constant, kind of a form of ethnic cleansing that is taking place. This is in part the result of not just Biden, but decades of U.S. policy in which there are zero consequences for these things. Mm-hmm. And I think what we are proposing is this crazy idea that there should be consequences for both sides. I mean, we have, the U.S. has kind of dominated a process over the years in which there are consequences for only one side, the weaker side, the side that is under occupation. And that has manifestly failed to, you know, it is pointed us away from peace.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of sort of like getting at the basic premise of your the piece, which is the status quo has failed. And it is a bipartisan status quo.
Yep.
As a status quo based on sort of sidelining the Palestinian issue.
Yep. Right.
And we are seeing, you know, on the positive side, like, you know, like even Joe Biden has kind of, you know, talking about the two-state solution again. So there's some, you know, glimmer of awareness that this is something that has to be addressed.
Right.
So, you know, having said all that, I mean, like, so there's a kind of diplomatic basis or model for this, like, you know, going back to Obama, as to how this could be done. And I think that there are people, you know, one sees this from the dissents that are coming within the State Department. There are people in the government that kind of realize the current policy has all the flaws that you've indicated.
Yeah.
I think the real question then goes back to the president. I mean, like, you know, this is one power that the president actually has of setting the foreign policy agenda. And this is the question I would kind of like ask for you. Like, I could conceivably imagine an American president, and it doesn't even have to be like a Democrat. Like, I could imagine, you know, like a Bush senior, in certain circumstances, like, you know, following the kind of path that you've outlined. Can I imagine Joe Biden doing that? Mm. I mean, this is what I would ask you. Like, can we imagine Joe Biden taking the path of realizing that, like, no daylight has not worked, is a disaster, and that is the sort of, you know, like a stumbling block that you have to push out of the way in order to get to a better place?
Yeah, it's difficult to imagine Joe Biden reversing or moving away from some of his kind of longstanding, I think, ideological, you know, commitments when it comes to Israel. And I do use the word ideological advisedly, because I do think, you know, his approach is, I think, much more ideological than people appreciate. But again, the approach that Nancy and I took, and this goes to the approach that we are taking at CIP. I mean, I moved over there just a few months ago. She's been the president since January 2022. And, you know, we are working together to build a new team and to build CIP into, you know, a much more energetic voice for progressive foreign policy. But what we really wanted to do in this piece was say, this is like the right policy. You know, this is the approach that the United States should take that could actually address this and promote real stability, promote real security and real dignity for people in the United States and for the region. Now, I understand other people can write pieces that are like, well, given the constraints that exist and given what we know Joe Biden will and will not do, here's what we can do. And I respect that. That's the approach they can take. But, you know, what we really wanted to do here was just say, listen, we need a shift. We are not going to nib. If we want to really address this problem such that we don't come back to war in Gaza in another 3-5 years, we will not succeed by simply nibbling around the edges. We will not succeed simply by focusing on Gaza. We need to really confront and address this problem as a whole.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think maybe on that point, I mean, like, Biden, obviously, you know, as president, has a huge amount of say in setting the agenda. But I think it's worth noting, you know, as I mentioned before, there is a sort of divisions, particularly in the Democratic coalition on this, and divisions within the government itself. Yeah. I mean, I think we've seen sort of like an extraordinary amount of internal dissent, you know, coming from within the dissent channels within the State Department, but also like even staffers in the White House and in Congress.
Yes.
And within like the, you know, Democrats in Congress, where I think the number of people, you know, calling for a ceasefire continues to kind of grow. And certainly in the polling, you know, like, you know, Biden's policy doesn't seem to be where like Democratic voters are, and particularly where Democratic voters are increasingly are like the you know, support for the war is has and a sort of blank check policy for Israel like is declining. So
and has been declining for some time. I mean, this the polls have been showing this trend for a long time.
And it's partially generational, right? Like it's very clearly you know, like the sort of younger members of the Democratic coalition are have really shifted on this. So this to me, I mean, like you have a set of sort of policy prescriptions, but I think for me the question is like, can those policy prescriptions be joined with like a, you know, a genuine mass movement? Like I think we're actually seeing I think it's something I wasn't expecting, but like a remarkable degree of like organizing and mass protest against this policy. You know, anyone who's followed this for a long time, like, will know, like, it's always been like a sort of uphill battle in American politics. And that seems to have shifted. Like, there is actually like a kind of momentum.
Yeah, it's clearly shifted, and it's been shifting for a long time. You know, I won't say I'm completely surprised. I mean, I do. I am impressed with the, you know, the organizing work that has been done by a lot of groups. But you know, when I see these dissents from huge numbers of, you know, State Department, you know, officials and from members of, you know, staff, congressional staff. I mean, I know a lot of these folks. I mean, these, as you said, I mean, we've seen this shifting within the Democratic Party as a whole, and that's represented in people who are working for this administration. This president and a lot of the party leadership are simply out of touch with where the party is when it comes to Israel-Palestine. And again, I'm not going to, and I absolutely reject the characterization of this as being somehow hostile to Israel. It is just a sense that, listen, the United States needs to take an even-handed approach here. We have two peoples, who both of whom deserve rights and security, and U.S. policy has overwhelmingly focused on the rights and security of one of these two groups, and that needs to change. I mean, the other point I'd add here, and I think this is particularly relevant, because, you know, I'm a foreign policy person. I would love it if foreign policy played a bigger role in our elections and everything like that, but I realize, you know, it's very rarely a top of mind issue for voters when they go to the polls. But this issue, the issue of Palestinian rights, ending the occupation, is one that really kind of connects to a broader set of kind of progressive values and principles. It's seen as an issue of social and racial justice. We saw this as part, you know, there's an element of this that connects to the Black Lives Matter movement, the protests that came up in the wake of George Floyd's murder, going back to the protests after Mike Brown. We saw, you know, conversations going on between activists in Palestine and the United States around this. And I think that's part of it as well. You know, so the question is, will this matter next year on Election Day? And again, I don't want to overstate the impact of any foreign policy issue, especially a year out, but the outrage that I am seeing, and I think that we're seeing in the polls as well, is really off the charts. It really is. And, you know, will these younger voters or these, you know, the people who are expressing these views, will they vote for Trump? Perhaps not. They may choose not to vote. But I think they will almost certainly not get out the vote. They will not phone bank. They will not knock on doors. They will not do the important work that is, you know, I think will be necessary for a Biden reelection. And, you know, if we're talking about a few hundred thousand votes in a few key states, which is, I think, almost certainly what this election will come down to, given how tightly polarized we are. This could matter. I think the White House needs to be thinking very, very seriously about that.
No, absolutely. No. So, I think it is one of the rare cases where public opinion can change it, get involved with foreign policy and change it. And I think it actually offers an interesting opportunity for people who are involved with foreign policy to, like, you know, engage the public in a way that I think, you know, most foreign policy decisions don't. But I mean, like, one, you know, possible model, although I know it's in some circles considered a controversial point of comparison, but there was, you know, a huge political consensus supporting apartheid South Africa in the United States for many decades, you know, in the 50s, 60s, and it started to change in the 70s, partially because the issue resonated with American domestic struggles on race. You know, there was a mass movement that was really able to, like, bring this issue to the fore and challenge the sort of, you know, the, what we could call the Kissinger consensus view on apartheid to do a little callback. So, I mean, there are ways, there are examples.
I would just note here, I mean, that's exactly right, which is part of why, you know, the Israeli government for years has been anticipating that and working very diligently in the United States and elsewhere to kind of, to conflate criticism with Israel with anti-Semitism. I mean, that's just the fact, unfortunately. I mean, we see a really unprecedented, I mean, you know, the fact, you know, the, just look at, you know, kind of anti-BDS measures being written into state law. I mean, imagine if South Africa were doing something like that. You know, if, you know, no criticizing apartheid, you have to sign this pledge that you won't criticize South Africa or sign on to boycotts of apartheid if you want to get this state job. I think the model, I think, you know, the Israeli government, the right wing, you know, the right wingers in Israel have been very conscious of that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, to some degree, you know, the sort of political repression and, censorship, that can work to some degree. But I mean, I actually do think that America, right now is such a pluralist society, and there are enough kind of, like, you know, norms of liberal democracy that I actually don't see that strategy like succeeding in the long run. Like, I think it could slow things down a lot. Which is bad because that means more suffering. I'm glad to have had this conversation because I do think that, like, you know, just looking at the news in Gaza and the West Bank and in the region as a whole, like, it's easy to sort of give into despair. But I was very grateful for your article offering a model for, like, more constructive thinking and also, like, you know, like, thinking politically in a way that, you know, we can actually get to, you know, the place that we want to be.
Right. Well, I really appreciate it. Thank you.